All right.
So we're at
2 Kings,
chapter 5. Let me hit those lights so y'all can see the screen. All right, last week we had the story of Naaman. If you were here last week, remember he's the Syrian general who has come down with leprosy. And he travels all the way to Samaria on the advice of his Jewish servant girl who has been captured in battle. She says, hey, there's a prophet in Samaria that can heal you. It's a shame you wouldn't go see him. And he goes to the king of Syria. The king of Syria sends a letter along with him and says, go ahead with my blessings. Go see if that guy can heal you. So he goes down to see Elisha. Remember, Elisha doesn't even come out to meet him. Sends his messenger out and says, go down to the Jordan River, dip yourself 7 times, and you'll be healed. And, of course, he's very skeptical about it. But his servants say, hey, what do you got to lose? Follow the prophet's instructions. He goes down there. He washes. Boom. Leprosy's healed. He goes directly back to Elisha in Samaria. He calls himself now, I'm your servant. And he proclaims God is the only true God. And he tries to give Elisha some of the lavish gifts that he brought with him. Remember, we talked about how much gold, silver, and clothing he had with him. 750 pounds of silver and 150 pounds of gold and all this other stuff. And so Elisha obviously turns that down. So he says, well, at least let me take some dirt back from Israel so I can build an altar to the one true God back in Syria. And Elisha grants that request. And then the last thing, if you remember, he asks forgiveness because he says, in my job as general in Syria, I'm going to have to go into the pagan worship services with the king. He says, I just want you to know that I'm not going to be worshiping. I'll be worshiping the one true God, but just forgive me the sin of even being in that worship house. And Elisha seems to say, go in peace. Right? You know, it is what it is. I think he values God's testimony in Syria more than him, you know, transgressing that line into the worship house. So that's where we are. And at the end of 19, it says, or at the beginning of verse 19, it says, and he said to him, go in peace. Elisha says to Naaman, go in peace. So Naaman gets in his chariot and heads back north. He's heading back up to Syria. And that's where we pick up because Elisha's servant, Gehazi, is not ready to let Naaman go. He saw a lot of stuff and he liked it. So right after go in peace, we're halfway through verse 19 in chapter 5. It says, but when Naaman had gone from him a short distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, See my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian in not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him. So Gehazi followed Naaman, and when Naaman saw someone running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, is all well? Like, why are you chasing me down? Do you need something else? And he said, all is well. My master has sent me to say, so there's lie number one, there have just now come to me from the hill country of Ephraim 2 young men of the sons of the prophets. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 changes of clothing. And Naaman said, be pleased to accept 2 talents. And he urged him and tied up 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of clothing. And he laid them on 2 of his servants, and they carried them before Gehazi. And when he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and put them in the house. And that's, you know, so he didn't go back to Elisha. He went by his house and stuffed him in the closet before he went back to see Elisha. And he sent the men away, and they departed. He went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, where have you been, Gehazi? And he said, your servant went nowhere. Another lie. But he said to him, did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male servants and female servants? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So he went out from his presence a leper like snow. So, whew. All right. So here's a note from the ESV Study Bible. It says, with the healing of Naaman, Elisha has involved himself with Syria for the first time. That involvement now occupies most of the attention of the authors for the next 2 chapters as they prepare the reader for the bloody events of chapters 8 through 10. So there's a lot of Syria in these next couple chapters. Okay, and there's our text. So what is Gehazi thinking here? Well, we don't really know his thought process. You know, we kind of mentioned it last week. It would be very easy, to rationalize what you're doing, right? The gift is there. You know, so much good could be done with this wealth. You know, it's so easy to kind of get your mind in a position where, you know, you could justify taking this. And Elisha obviously doesn't even go down that road. He stops himself before he even thinks about that. Gehazi does not. And he doesn't take a ton of stuff, but he takes enough to, in a dishonest way, to be stealing, right? I mean, it's pretty obvious that's what he's doing. He wants to get some of these goods that the Syrian brought as a gift. So he shows himself to be greedy, which is contrasted with Elisha's refusal, as well as Naaman's generosity. So who looks terrible in this story is Gehazi, because Elisha refuses to take money for something he didn't do. Remember, Elisha's not even there when the healing happens. He knows God did this, so for him to take money for God's doing would be way out of line. And then Naaman is, you know, over and beyond generous at this point. Here, take all this stuff. And Elisha says no, and, you know, I'm sure he wants to give Gehazi even more than he gives him. I mean, his generosity is overflowing at this point. And then you've got this guy that's taking stuff in a dishonest means. So we've got humility. We've got two guys that really know their place and one guy who doesn't seem to know his place. Okay? So there's Gehazi running away with the money. He appears, as one commentator said, opportunistic and duplicitous, grasping at those outpourings of gratitude which, in principle, Elisha has refused. So, I mean, I guess the best way we could, you know, illustrate it, it would be like one of us taking something out of the offering plate. You know, that's about the best way we can, you know, we take something that was given for God's work and we put it in our own pocket. That's what Gehazi has done. And he's done it by, you know, as dishonest a means as you can. You know, we've got several lies going on here. And if he wasn't ashamed of it, he wouldn't have gone and run to his house and hid it before he went back to see Elijah. You know, if this was really going to go to God's work, wouldn't he have brought it back to Elisha and said, hey, I just thought this might... He probably still would have got rebuked at that point, but you know he's trying to hide it because he knows he's wrong. So when he catches up to Naaman, Gehazi lies to get silver and clothing, and he stashes the loot before he sees Elisha. So I saw this story just a few weeks ago out of High Point, because I used to live in High Point, and it was this pastor and his wife who embezzled $40,000 from their church. And the reason I came across this is one of my former students up at Wesleyan, this guy married her and her husband probably 2 years ago. So it was up on Facebook. And how many of these can we think about over the years, these financial scandals in churches? That's exactly what Gehazi is doing here. He's taking what was meant to honor God or to honor the prophet, and he's taking it for his own gain. And then we've got this idea here. So they take $40,000 from the church. There was another one that just last week I saw. A guy was taking money from the church funds to pay off a mistress so she wouldn't talk. And I think he took $50,000 or something out of his church fund to pay off the mistress so she wouldn't talk. And yeah, so yeah. So it you see these stories come out, and you wonder why the public perception, because this is what's going to get the publicity on the news channel. You know, this is what the church is. You know, they'll put good stories about the church on the news. You're going to see this. You're going to see Westboro Baptist Church all the time. You know, they're going to get all kinds of publicity. But churches that actually preach the word, they're not getting on TV. They're not getting that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, you saw that they'll do whatever they can to cut that. If you start talking about that in an interview, they'll go ahead and cut the interview. You saw the Clemson coach last week. I don't know if anybody saw that, but after the game, he was thanking Jesus for the win, for the ability and all this other stuff. And poof, all of a sudden it cut to a dead studio. The guys at the studio weren't even ready for the feed. They just cut it right in the middle of the talk. They did it to Benjamin Watson. He's a tight end for the Saints on a couple different stations. Poof, cut him right off, go to the next story. That stuff doesn't make the news. The gospel is not newsworthy in our modern culture, but this stuff is always on the news. So that's why we have this perception of the church. And so it doesn't take many bad apples to... Yeah. Ruin our bunch, you know?
Right.
So here's a thought. Being around the truth is never really enough, okay? Because I love this quote, but Judas Iscariot went to the best seminary in the world for 3 years, and yet he was lost, you know? I mean, Gehazi is around Elisha. He sees these miracles probably almost daily. He knows that God is real. He knows it's not in this moment that Gehazi doubts God exists. Right, that's not the thought process. It's like a, I don't know. I think sin is kind of a. It's when we get into these sinful behaviors, it's not that we don't think God is there. It's that we lose the ability to, you know. It's like it fades. He becomes distant. He becomes, you know. We put him in a box. We marginalize him. We justify our own behaviors by trying to distance ourselves from God. We don't go in thinking, well, there's no God, and I don't care, there's no consequence to sin. But we become dead to the consequences. You know, we marginalize who God is, and that's how we do our. I mean, how else can you commit these sins when you're in God? We all commit sins, right? And then you afterwards you're like, this, I'm so stupid. Why did I act like that? Why did I say that? Why did I do that? And it's because God doesn't move, we move. We're the ones that run from that, and we put ourselves in that position, and we allow sin to come between us. And so I think that's what you got with Gehazi. He gets greedy, he indulges that sin, and he pushes all truth aside and rationalizes his own behavior. You know, I think that's human nature. So Elijah confronts Gehazi with the, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" And I thought that sounded a lot like the Garden of Eden. You know, why were you hiding, Adam? Where were you? You know, I think it's the same. He knows. Elisha knows, just like God knew. Where have you been? If you ever know your kid did something, hey, what were you doing up there? Nothing. Really? Nothing. That's what Gehazi says. No, I wasn't doing anything. You know, it's like the day when James came out and he had black marks all over his face. I said, "Have you been messing with mommy's makeup?" Nope. Let's go look in the mirror. No, I mean, it's just covered. At least it looked like war paint. It wasn't like, you know, something trying to make up on. That would have been a whole other level of discipline. But, you know, that's what kids do. You know, you get caught and I wasn't doing anything, you know. And so he lies, but this time he's lied to a man who knows he's being dishonest. He lied to Naaman. Naaman didn't know any better. Naaman said, "Oh, this guy works for Elisha. Of course he must be telling the truth." Now he lies to Elisha, and Elisha knows the deal. Right? So Elisha pronounces a pretty strict judgment at the end of this, right? Now you get leprosy and your descendants. Right? It's almost like you get a flip-flop, you know, vice versa, Freaky Friday thing going on with Naaman and Gehazi. Naaman all comes in as a leper and leaves a faithful believer. Gehazi comes in a faithful believer and leaves a leper. You know, it's almost like they just switched roles, right? You want to go and lie and cheat and steal, then that's what's going to happen to you.
What went through Naaman's mind? That's, you know, going back. Was he just saying, "Oh, that's kind of strange. You didn't want it."
Yeah.
Now he comes up there.
Well, he had the whole backstory. Hey, these guys just showed up when you left, and they're in need. So, I mean, it seems like a legitimate story. I don't know.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
There.
Throw it out.
Talking about, you know, him taking the money from Elijah City. Where would the church stand on a lottery?
Wow.
I mean, I'm just going to say this. You know, say if I won the lottery, and to me, the lottery is for education. It's supposed to be an education lottery.
Supposed to be.
We don't see a lot of that. Yeah. So I'll win the lottery, and I want to give the Academy $1 million.
That 10%.
That would be interesting, right? Tradition would say, obviously not. You wouldn't do that. But I think it becomes a little muddy because are there not other things that we do that it are much worse stewardship of money than buying a $5 lottery ticket?
Yes.
I mean, you know, we waste our money on a lot of stuff that has no chance of giving us any return. So, I never had any interest in the lottery ticket before I got saved, and I really don't have any now. But I don't think it's as cut and dry as our tradition has made it. Because there's a lot of ways to be bad stewards of money that we don't ever bring up. But the lottery ticket is one that always gets brought up. So, I don't know. I think there's a personal conviction thing there, and I mean, I think the downside of the lottery is it does target those that don't have much money. You know, it targets this get-rich-quick kind of thing. It's like the televangelists and stuff. You know, rich people don't send the televangelists any money. It's people that are desperate to get out of the situation and don't have much. It does. You know, so I think there's a negative side in that. You know, it comes down now. It used to be you would never even pick up a deck of cards, you know, and now you can. Now you can play cards and there's nothing wrong with it. You know, I mean, I just think it becomes personal conviction, what's going on there, and, you know, it doesn't change the truth, but.
Yeah, but if you do the math, it's much better to put the money into visiting or creating a business
right.
than ever playing a lottery ticket.
Sure, yeah.
If you do the math, just you have better chances of making millions with business or
Yeah, I think he had a better chance of like getting eaten by a shark or, you know, getting struck by lightning.
I mean,
yeah. Yeah, it's hard to put concrete hope in any of that stuff. I don't know. I think it's.
Yeah.
Oh, it mentioned in the lottery? How about that? Yeah. Supposed to warn it. We all could have plugged our ears on that. All right. So.
Yeah, we'll go further.
Oh. All right. So. Again, one man goes away healed because of his obedience. The other man, the guy who should have known better, goes away with the disease. That what we covered last week is a terminal disease at this point, an isolating disease, and one that's just going to get progressively worse as the years go on. It is not a fun way to go. And so yet another Israelite has made the tragic mistake of choosing a substitute for the Lord, while a Gentile convert has discovered that what his servant girl said about the Lord is true. So another example of an Israelite not knowing God, and a Gentile putting faith in God. There are hints of this all over the Old Testament towards the gospel in the future. You know, that these Gentile people seem to place faith in God when the people that are supposed to be doing it mess it up. The ones that are in the very presence of God don't have true faith, and the ones that are outside end up putting true faith in God. So I think it made me think of these stories in the gospel, right? Matthew 8, when he had entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly." And he said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion replied, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it." And when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith." You know, a soldier that, you know, a Roman centurion, a pagan, who isn't supposed to know what anything from anything, has enough sense to put his faith in Christ. And then Mark 7, "And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, 'Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs,'" a reference to her being a Gentile. Mm-hmm. "But she answered him, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs on the table eat the children's crumbs.' And he said to her, 'For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter.' And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone." And so just these small pictures of all Israel is not always Israel. You know, there are people outside. There are sheep of another fold that I'm going to bring in here. And I think there's hints of that all over the Old Testament and even in Jesus' ministry before all that gets revealed. Okay, so Elisha's next miracle that we hit in the next part of the text. Yeah, go ahead.
So it sounds like Elisha is bringing judgment onto his servant. Is this something that God's given him authority to do, or is this something that God's revealed to him? I mean, that's a kind of a thin line there, mm-hmm. between what he did with. I mean, that's a terrible judgment.
Yeah.
So is that something he just thought he could do? Or
well, I mean, that's.
I would think that was God's divine inspiration to Elijah from the very beginning. I think it was orchestrated before they even took Naaman down to the river. I was just sitting here thinking about that myself.
Because
it's almost kind of ironic. Look, you go down there with him because you're getting ready to see what's going to happen to you. Possibly, I don't, you know, but that's what I took it.
Yeah, I wish we had a little more background on. Did Elisha look out the window and see him going down the road? Did you know? I think surely God has directed his actions here. I think that would be. I mean, does Elisha have the authority on his own to just put this kind of thing on? You know, but then again, like I said when we covered Elijah and the drought. I think Elijah goes up there as a righteous man and says, "It's not going to rain until I say it's going to rain," and God honors the statement. I think that's what the text kind of says in that. So there's a little bit of gray area there, but with something like this, it seems like that would be a godly judgment, you know, because it goes to him and his
and his descendants. So God's got to be involved in this somehow. So, yeah, I think it's judgment. All right, so the next miracle, it seems like it's a really, you know, kind of minor miracle. So we won't spend a ton of time on it. But it parallels the multiplying of oil in chapter 4, the curing of the stew. Remember, that was just kind of an interesting little thing. And then the feeding of the 100. So each of these stories portrays Elisha saving the prophets or the prophets' families from physical want or financial disaster. And his miraculous powers help him to be the perfect master in these crisis situations. It almost Elisha is just in the everyday dealings of people. You know, he's not just this untouchable prophet up in an ivory tower somewhere that just kind of comes down on special occasions. He seems to get involved with even small things. And that's what's going to happen in the next section. So 1 through 7 here. It says, "Now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, 'See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan and each of us get there a log and let us make a place for us to dwell there.' And he answered, 'Go.'" So apparently there was a lodging place for the prophets. You know, it was kind of like a monastery of sorts, you know, that kind of thing. But all the prophets seemed to have families, too. So maybe they just went there during the day and then and came back. They had different shifts. I don't really know. But that where we're staying is too small for us. Can we go get some wood and build a new place? And Elisha says, go for it. Then one of them said, "Be pleased to go with your servants." And he answered, "I will go." So he went down with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water, and he cried out, "Alas, my master, it was borrowed. That wasn't my axe head." Then the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" When he showed him the place, he cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. And he said, "Take it up." So he reached out his hand and took it. All right, so another one of those stories where you're like, why is that here? I don't know that I have a perfect answer for you, but again, it seems like these prophets lived together, ate together, worked together, these company of prophets. Remember when Elijah, before Elijah got taken up to heaven, the company of prophets was following him around. So it seems like there was a big group of prophets that worked under the authority of Elijah and now Elisha, and they lived in one place. And so they go down the Jordan to build this place. So when they're cutting down the wood, you know, I tried to find a nice little picture of some guy swinging an axe and the axe head flying off, but I couldn't find it. It's some cartoon or something. but the axe head falls off and goes into the water, and it was borrowed. That wasn't my axe head. Well, that's the whole thing that's going on here. Apparently these prophets are pretty poor, right? They don't have money. This is what they do. They do the work of God. They depend on everybody else to support them. And so if he loses this axe head, he's going to have to pay back whoever he borrowed it from. And apparently this is quite a substantial debt. And he's not going to be able to pay this debt off. And so the prophet just incurred a debt that he could not possibly pay. And Elisha, through the power of God, removed the debt from the prophet's account. So I think it's just like a mini gospel lesson. You know, this guy had a debt that could not be paid, and the man of God just removed that debt. You know, your debt is paid. Here, where is it? Boom, throw the stick in. It comes back up. Maybe you could take the stick to the cross. You know, that's a stretch, but, you know, it's wood and wood. I'm just trying to figure out why the heck this is here. You know, it just seems like this little side story, and there's got to be some importance to it. And I know a man's debt was just erased when that axe head floated up to the top of the water. So when in doubt, run to the gospel. So I think maybe that's what's going on here. All right, now we've got a long section to kind of finish here. You can see that there. I don't know if we'll get through all of it. We'll see what we can get through today, and then we'll finish next week what we don't get. All right, so verse 8. "Once, when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, 'At such and such a place shall be my camp.' But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, 'Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there.' And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him so that he saved himself there more than once or twice." So what's going on here is Syria plans an attack on Israel. And Elisha goes to the king and says, "Hey, don't go over there because there's armies there." And so every time Syria tries to attack, it backfires. It doesn't work. And it's like the Israelites know that the Syrians are coming because Elisha is telling the king that they're coming. All right. So in the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, "Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?" All right. Who's talking? Who's my traitor? Who's my double agent? Because he knows my every move. Okay? Who is telling the king that we're going to be in this place and then this place and then this place? Because every time we go, the Israelites have it stacked up or evacuated that area or whatever. And he wants to know who the double agent is.
And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." The words in the back room where you're the only one there, Elisha tells the king those words. He hears everything. And he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him." Where is this Elisha? I got to get this guy. If he's the one that's messing up our battles, I need to take him. And it was told him, "Behold, he is in Dothan." So he sent their horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. So he sends a whole army to besiege the city to find Elisha. And when the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, apparently he got a new servant, not Gehazi. The servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" Because all he sees is being surrounded here. He said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Please strike this people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he led them to Samaria. So he prays for his servant. His servant looks up, and he sees chariots of fire all on the mountainside behind the Syrian army. So they are not the only ones there. The angel armies have showed up in support. Chariots of fire, just like we saw with Elijah. So the same one that took Elijah to heaven is going to protect Elisha now on earth. And so he goes out there and he does kind of the Jedi mind trick, right? These are not the droids you're looking for. And he takes him to Samaria and they follow him. So they're struck blind, at least, you know, blind in the sense that they don't know what's really going on, and takes him to Samaria. And then as soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, "O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see." So the Lord opened their eyes and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. So kind of a, you know, hypnosis kind of thing. You're awake now, and now they're surrounded by the Israelite army there in Samaria. And as soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, "My father," which is interesting to call him that, "shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down?" And he answered, "You shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master." So he prepared for them a great feast. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. Okay, so how about that?
Why the Arameans fighting Israel? And Naaman was...
Yes, he is. Yeah, it's Syria and Israel had kind of a long history here, and
you would
it's
think that Naaman was kind of
you would think, but I think what we said last, you know, you never hear Naaman's name again, so maybe he doesn't participate in this part, or maybe, I mean, he seemed to be some small raiding party, and we're not done because Ben-Hadad in the next section is going to besiege Syria again, besiege Israel again. So these Syrians are always. It's just always that's the border, and that's always the ones that are fighting. And Israel, remember, Israel has a tough time. The northern kingdom has a tough time keeping peace because their kings are always going in the wrong direction. And so God allows a lot of this invasion stuff to happen. Now, we won't get into all of this stuff today because we only got, 4 minutes left? I got 3 on my phone. So just to get us a warm-up for next week. Syria again is making war against Israel, this time by sending a series of raiding parties across the border, and they've been doing this forever. Remember, Naaman's servant is his servant because she was taken in a raiding party that came across the border. So it seems to be little skirmishes out on the frontier. You know, somebody comes across, they take a city, they raid a city and get stuff and run back over the border. So this isn't a prolonged war. It's these kind of quick-hit guerrilla kind of things going on in the war. So, unfortunately, the Syrians, Elisha just discerns where their armies will strike, and tells Israel's king, which spoils Syria's plan. So if I'm a raiding company, I need stuff. I need to go in and I need to come back with spoil. So Elisha says, hey, they're going to attack that city next. So the king would go in, send word. They would evacuate that city and move all their stuff to another city. So when the Syrians get there, there's nothing to take. You know, then they run back. Okay, well, we'll go to this city next. Elisha says, they're coming to that city. They evacuate that city. When he gets there, there's nothing to take. And so the Syrian king is getting really frustrated by this and wants to take care of Elisha. So Elisha is Israel's best line of defense. And when you think about the whole theme that God told Israel all the way through is, I'm your king. I'm your protector. You know, I'm the one you need to put your trust in.
And what do the Israelites always do? Yeah, but we really want a king. We really want bigger armies. Even, you know, Solomon and everybody else, they wanted chariots, they wanted horses, they wanted armies, they wanted boats, they wanted all this stuff. And God keeps telling them, you don't need all that stuff. If you just trust me, you wouldn't have any problems. Yeah, we know, Lord, we trust you, but we really want a king. But if you really just trust me, things wouldn't happen. Yeah, we know, but we need a bigger army. You know, and so it's this lack of trust in God, and the only one that can prevent them from being damaged by these raiding parties is the man of God, is the prophet that's sending word from God to do this. And again, you'd think people would start paying attention, but we stupid humans with our sin nature, we don't.
Did people really realize that this is coming from God? I mean, they see Elijah, and the hope is that they know that's coming from God through Elijah.
Yeah.
The people aren't thinking that it's Elijah.
Well, I mean, there's probably a temptation there. I mean, that's what Naaman thinks. That's what, how many times have we, you know, almost deified a preacher? You know, I mean, we put these guys on pedestals sometimes. And, he's such a great preacher. He's such a great this. There's always a danger in that.
I always think about the people, how they feel about the Pope sometimes.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah. I mean, think about that. I mean, how many people have put him in a position above man? So, yeah, I think that's a very real possibility, I think. All right, we'll pick that up next week. I'm kind of excited about that section because that's why I didn't want to rush it today. But there's some interesting parallels here between that and some things that happened in 1967 in the Six-Day War with Israel that I'll try to tie in. It's pretty cool. So I'm going to close this in prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this time and for your word. And thank you for another productive day in it. And continue to teach us from it and mold us to what you would have us to be. Bless the services today in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks, guys.